Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. A great opportunity for you this hour. You have a chance to win a three-night San Francisco treat giveaway for two. So support the local programming and local news you count on right now with a call to 888-774-9150.
Quick check of Valley traffic. The 60 westbound, there's an accident blocking the shoulder at Mill. And the 60 eastbound, an accident blocking the on-ramp at Superstition Springs Boulevard. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 94 degrees. Clear tonight, lows near 70. It's sunny and 88 degrees.
The Valley is mourning the death of a Phoenix police officer who was shot in the line of duty. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from our West Valley Bureau, Dave Glasser was based in the Maryvale precinct in West Phoenix.
Phoenix police say Glasser and his partner were attacked by an unidentified suspect when they responded to a burglary call in Levine on Wednesday. Phoenix firefighters rushed Glasser to St. Joseph's Hospital, where officials described him as being in extremely critical condition and fighting for his life. Police Chief Joseph Yonner says that at 6 feet 4 inches tall, Glasser was larger than life.
Dave served his community, and he continues to serve right now as he is donating his organs for the betterment of people he doesn't even know. We lost a hero. We lost an outstanding member of our community, a father, and a great police officer.
Glasser is the first Phoenix police officer to be fatally shot in the line of duty since Detective John Hobbs was killed in 2014. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Governor Doug Ducey has signed into law four new interstate licensing compacts for medical professionals: doctors, nurses, psychologists, and physical therapists. The hope is that allowing these providers to practice here without having to get licensed here will make it easier to recruit them to Arizona. For more on this, I'm joined by Tara Plesch, Chief External Affairs Officer for the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers, which advocated for the Physician Compact. Tara, why do you think we saw so many of these interstate compact bills this year?
I think it goes back to 2014, when we had a tremendous backup in licensure for physicians. For my community health centers, this became very problematic, especially for those in remote rural areas. And oftentimes, those were physicians coming from other states who had been thoroughly vetted, had extensive background checks, had produced all of the paperwork that they needed to be licensed in another state. When they came to Arizona, found that there were more roadblocks, and it was virtually impossible to get licensed in a reasonable amount of time.
So do you think that this interstate compact will help alleviate some of that problem?
We do believe that it will. This, we hope, will encourage those who are licensed and in good standing in other states to be able to practice in multiple states and have licenses in more than one state if they are adjoining compact states. And there are currently 13 with Arizona. There will be 13 compact states. Six of those will be in the West, which is really encouraging for my health centers up in northern Arizona who can really be helped by those physicians who can practice across the border. And for the telemedicine program, that is particularly advantageous.
So do you think that this would be maybe more helpful in some of those health centers that are, as you say, on a state border where a physician can be working in multiple states at one time, as opposed to maybe trying just to recruit a physician to relocate exclusively to Arizona and leave where they've been practicing previously and come start to practice here?
Well, one of the things that I have heard from my colleagues is they see it to be very advantageous for those physicians who might want to come to the Valley for just the winter months. Perhaps they're coming from a state where there is an exodus during the winter months and then people return back to those states in the summer. So that would give them the ability to come and practice here when there is a greater demand and go back to the state from where they've originated and practice there in the summer.
How much of a dent do you think these compacts could put into the doctor and nursing shortage that Arizona's been dealing with for a while?
It's hard to predict, but we're very encouraged by the fact that the other compact states have been very effective in their ability to draw in more licensed professionals into their states. And a lot of it has to do, again, with going back to the waiting period for licensure. I think that that's one of the things that discourages providers from moving from state to state is the fact that that licensure period can be long, onerous, difficult to get through. And in the meantime, they basically cannot practice because they have not been licensed in that state. And once they are licensed, then there's that period of time to get them credentialed so they can actually get reimbursed for their services. This just shortens the time for both of those processes.
So do you think that by joining this interstate compact, Arizona becomes a more attractive place for doctors and nurses to come practice?
I'm convinced it is. Yes, absolutely.
Tara Plesch is the Chief External Affairs Officer for the Arizona Alliance for Community Health Centers. To find out if her optimism about Arizona becoming a more attractive place for doctors and nurses to practice is shared, I'm joined by Cecilia Beard. She's Vice President of StarMed, which is a healthcare recruiting firm. And Cecilia, do these kinds of compacts make it easier for places that need medical professionals to get them to go there?
Yes, easy answer is absolutely. It does make it easier because it makes the onboarding process much faster for organizations. For the candidates, it's just easier for them to look at opportunities in states where they already have the licensure. They know it's going to be easy for them to get onboarded, and so it makes all of a sudden a state that may not consider under a geographic preference all of a sudden a state that they will consider. So states that don't fall under the compact license, like California, a lot of organizations in those states are having a harder time recruiting physicians and nurses because the licensing process in the state of California can be more challenging and sometimes very lengthy.
When you talk to physicians during the process of recruiting and trying to place folks, does this issue come up for them?
It really comes up more on the organization side, I think. When we're talking to organizations about assisting them with their recruitment needs, a lot of times they will say because they are pressed for time, they need somebody to come on board quickly, and they don't have a lot of time to wait for a candidate to get their license. They're looking for individuals that already have licensure. And so it just allows them to onboard a candidate quickly. It allows them to start generating revenue quickly, especially if it's a position they've had open for a while. So under the compact license, it allows them to consider candidates and widen the candidate pool significantly.
How much of a dent can something like this make in a physician shortage in a state like Arizona?
I don't think we can quantify it simply because the physician shortage is at a national level. So we have rural communities, medium-sized communities, metropolitan communities that are looking for physicians, especially in the primary care area. But it can definitely be a huge assistance in the sense that if the easier you make it for a candidate to work in your state, the easier it is to recruit them.
Do you think that this will continue to be a popular thing that more states will continue to do? I mean, could you imagine a scenario under which all 50 states accept each other's medical licenses?
You know, I think that this is definitely a trend that will continue. I think the other benefit to licensing physicians this way, it does allow, you know, states to communicate amongst themselves and look at any disciplinary issues or any quality issues that may come up. When you have separate states that really don't communicate with others, you have to look at each state individually to look up disciplinary issues and things along those lines. And from a quality perspective, as an organization, to really ensure that they're bringing on board and they're hiring a physician that has a clean background, this will be a benefit. So I do think that not only from a recruitment perspective and onboarding quickly, also from a quality perspective, I think this is a trend that we will continue seeing.
Cecilia Beard is vice president of StarMed, a healthcare recruiting firm.
The recently approved state budget for the next fiscal year allocated $1.5 million for the Arizona Commission on the Arts. In an overall package of more than $9.5 billion, that may not seem like much, but the current fiscal year provided $0 for the commission. Jamie Dempsey, deputy director for the commission, joins me to tell us more about what could be done with that new money. Jamie, there's concern the arts have been cut back dramatically in schools. Can this funding allow the commission to step in to fill the void?
There exists a narrative about the arts being lost in Arizona schools and across our country. What we have found to be true from the research is that it is not necessarily the case that there are decreased opportunities in school to participate in arts-based learning. It's just very inconsistent. Poorer neighborhoods, struggling schools, they are really challenged to provide arts-based learning, where children in wealthier neighborhoods have access to broad opportunities to participate in arts and culture in schools. Whether the times are lean or not so lean, we as an agency always make arts learning. It's a central priority for us. And so with this new funding, we will also bolster some of our arts learning grant programs, which support artist residencies for youth. They also support artist residencies for older adults in lots of locations. And they help partner arts organizations with those struggling schools for mutually beneficial outcomes.
When groups go to ask the legislature or the governor for more money in future years, is there that pressure to say, okay, with that $1.5 million, we did this and these were the results?
I think so. I think that's true for every sector, honestly. The arts sector in Arizona has engaged for several years in an effort that is called the Cultural Data Project. We are able to aggregate and analyze data in financial and participation data on behalf of arts and culture. We're able to quantify those evidence-based outcomes. There might be a pressure to provide visible results, and honestly, we're excited about that as well. There have been several programs over the last few years that we have invented that were really exciting, and two of those had to be put on hiatus due to funding constraints this year. Community Catalyst, which supported partnerships between arts organizations and non-arts organizations in rural communities. We also ran a program called Arizona Art Tank. They were public live pitch events in communities across Arizona, and they made investments in innovative arts-based ventures.
And Jamie, without the state funding, what has the commission done in terms of fundraising, in terms of where its money comes from?
We have engaged in broader, more expansive private partnerships. We have significant programming partnerships with local and national foundations. The challenge is that local and national foundations don't generally want to give a public agency funding for grant making, because if they wanted to grant funds, they would do it themselves. They would do it directly.
How important do you think it is for the art that the commission helps come to fruition is very much something that feels like Arizona?
We think it's so important that the work that we support is reflective of what Arizonans value and what is relevant to them. There are always a lot of discussions about the challenges that we face in funding here. Arts leaders and community leaders are constantly talking about the solutions that they have seen elsewhere. And I think those conversations are really valuable to have, to explore what has worked and what hasn't worked in other communities. But ultimately, what will work in Arizona is what is unique to Arizona, that capitalizes on our unique strengths and talents and the potential of our arts organizations and our creatives and the work that's happening in arts learning.
Jamie Dempsey is Deputy Director for the Arizona Commission on the Arts. The Arizona Supreme Court will soon expand from 5 to 7 justices, now that Governor Doug Ducey has signed HB 2537. In his signing letter, the governor wrote, quote, "Some have said this bill is unnecessary and that the court can handle its caseload just fine. But I believe you'll hear a different story from the businesses and individuals facing litigation who are in need of certainty." That's from Governor Ducey's letter explaining why he approved the addition of 2 more justices to Arizona's high court. Attorney Tim Nelson, who is general counsel for Governor Janet Napolitano, is one who's concerned about the new law. Tim, what's your reaction to the governor's move?
Well, it's certainly a very interesting development. I think it's part of maybe a national trend to try to increase the number of conservatives on the judiciary. In Arizona, I was not under the impression that our Supreme Court was overworked and that there was a need for additional people, and particularly with a party registration breakdown of four Republicans and one Democrat on the current Supreme Court, this seems like an effort for Governor Ducey to be able to put on two additional Republicans and stack the court even more heavily towards conservatives.
One of the things the governor and his supporters have said is that because of Arizona's merit selection system, this is going to keep that sort of court-packing accusation at bay, because regardless, he's going to appoint people who are highly qualified. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I do think he will appoint highly qualified people. He has appointed some very qualified judges in the past. What concerns me is that when he originally ran for governor, he said specifically he was not looking to appoint judicial activists, and yet the only appointment he has made so far to the Supreme Court is a person who is a self-described judicial activist who wrote, I think, recently about the case for an activist judiciary. So I think there's a little bit of a concern that he is looking for a court that's going to become a little bit more activist on the conservative side.
Is this something you think could become an issue for Democrats to get more involved in future elections?
I think so. I really think it's something that all Arizonans need to be paying attention to. The importance of our Supreme Court and of our judiciary in the whole political system is crucial, and the idea that it could be threatened with partisanship or particularly with people who are pursuing an activist agenda toward partisanship is alarming, and it's something we need to watch very closely. I hope that the current Supreme Court won't do that, but I think that the trends that we're seeing nationwide and certainly here in Arizona are toward an aggressive effort to try to essentially lock the court into a much more conservative mode than it has been.
Are there certain issues you're watching out for? Are there certain bigger things that make you concerned for the future?
Well, certainly I think the typical hot button judiciary issues, whether it be pro-choice, the rights of homosexuals or other minorities, you might start to see a court that is at odds with what the public wants and expects with regard to individual liberties.
Tim Nelson of the Nelson Law Group. He was also general counsel to Governor Janet Napolitano. Tim, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Steve.
Arizona is not alone in changing the makeup of its highest state court. To learn more, I'm joined by Bill Raftery, senior analyst at the National Center for State Courts. Bill, what are some other states doing with their high courts?
Georgia, in the last 30 to 60 days, has signed legislation to add two justices to their court of last resort. You've seen similar efforts introduced in a variety of states, Florida, North Carolina, and using many of the same arguments of the proponents, which effectively were, we're a bigger state, we need a bigger court, we need a more efficient court, with the idea that more justices equals greater efficiency. You've also seen, I think, in the last 10 years in particular, an effort to change the number and composition of the court of last resort for a variety of states in the other direction. And I would point to instances such as Michigan, where Democrats tried to remove two seats on the Michigan Supreme Court. Washington State, it was Republicans who, displeased with certain decisions of the Washington State Supreme Court with respect to K-12 funding, attempted to reduce that court from its current 9 members down to 5 members. You had one member of the Montana legislature say in committee that he wanted to reduce the Montana Supreme Court because he wanted to force the justices to accept tort reform, and that if you reduce the number of justices, they would have to accept it, or they would have to accept a huge influx of cases and less staff and less justices to be able to handle it.
Have we seen other periods of time where it's been like this, or is this finally a case where lawmakers say, we have a state Supreme Court or a court of last resort, let's take advantage of this?
prior to about, I would say, the late 1990s into the 2000s, most of the time when a state Supreme Court saw its membership changed, it was based upon a constitutional amendment. It was based upon reworking the entire judiciary. And the example I would use here is from your neighboring state, Nevada. Nevada increased its Supreme Court because they could not get what's called a court of appeals, an intermediate appellate court, passed by the voters. And they needed additional justices in order to handle some of the cases that were coming before them. Now, what's happened, now that the voters of Nevada did approve of court of appeals, the Nevada Supreme Court is actually shrinking over time. And, you know, but again, that was always within the context of let's restructure the entire judiciary.
Here in Arizona, there was an active negotiation going on between the Chief Justice of the Arizona Supreme Court and the governor or some of the governor's advisors to tie support of expanding the court to extra funding for the overall judicial branch. A little bit of funding ended up being added, but only about a tenth of what was hoped for or what was expected to some extent. Are you seeing examples in other states where there negotiations like this are taking place, or has it been, as you've said, sort of the legislature deciding, we're not exactly sure we like what the judicial branch is doing, so we're going to do this?
In the case of Florida, the Speaker of the House there attempted to create basically a second Supreme Court to handle civil appeals, and there'd be another one to handle criminal. And there the proposal was to guarantee, I think it was about 1.5% of all general revenue funds would automatically go towards the judiciary. And so there have been efforts to link additional funding for courts to this.
Bill Raftery is a senior analyst at the National Center for State Courts. We've been talking about how Arizona and other states are modifying their high courts. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Okie dokie, here we go. My name is Sylvia Burns, and I'm learning how to sew. I'm still a beginner. I'm learning about the proper way to cut, the proper way to sew.
Line that up. Go ahead, keep on going.
How to sew on a zipper, which has been great because that was a hindrance for me.
Okay. I wondered why it was like that.
One of the reasons why I'm wanting to learn to sew is because I have a great niece who's 2.5 years old, and I love to sew for her. She wants Minnie Mouse, she wants Tinkerbell, and I have to be able to cut the right way, sew the right way. Doesn't that look awesome? That's not bad. I've never been able to put on a zipper before.
That's Sylvia Burns taking a sewing class at Sewing Nuts in Scottsdale. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just think we need to take the inseam in a little, send us a note, the show at kjzz.org.
The Phoenix City Council this week started taking votes to approve a new city budget, but the fate of a proposed secondary property tax increase is less certain. The levy would raise $37 million and would be used to make debt service payments. I spoke with Phoenix City Manager Ed Zerker a couple of weeks ago and asked him about that.
The $37 million, what it does is it allows us to pay our debt service costs. We have to pay that. That's the money we're paying for the police stations, fire stations, parks, libraries, storm basins that we've built over the last 30 years. When we take care of that question, then it allows us to use the budget surplus that we have for the things that people say they want for their quality of life.
Phoenix City Manager Ed Zerker speaking a couple of weeks ago about the proposed property tax increase in the new city budget. Some critics of that idea say the city shouldn't be raising taxes when it has a budget surplus. Others worry about the impact on homeowners. Kevin McCarthy, president of the Arizona Tax Research Association, is one of the plan's critics.
The issue that City of Phoenix is struggling with in the adoption of this budget is an ongoing problem that I would describe it at the City of Phoenix. What I would characterize as misled property taxpayers in the city for many, many years about what the property tax implications are for paying the debt service on bonds. They have, for the last, I think, probably 2 decades, have told taxpayers when they went to them to approve bonds that these bonds were essentially free because they had committed to this, what I would call a political tax rate of $1.82. we tried to inform taxpayers and voters at that time that hundreds of millions in bonds are hardly free, and they have to be paid back, and they are going to cost hundreds of millions to pay back. The city now is faced with a challenge where the amount that they're currently levying for those bonds is less than what's required to pay back the bondholders.
Do you think it makes it a tougher sell to residents that a tax increase would pay for debt service payments as opposed to something that residents can actually see, like a new park or a police station or better streets, things that are more tangible than a debt service payment?
No doubt about it. And one of the reasons why they've been under-levying in the last couple of years is that they have been shifting capacity for those very things that are more tangible in the operating budget, whether it's hiring new police officers and firefighters or trying to maintain the city's infrastructure. They, though, are now at a point where they can't continue to do that without shifting back and actually increasing the debt service levy and actually decreasing the operational tax rate that we call the primary tax rate without eclipsing that $1.82 that they've long held themselves to.
Obviously, for some homeowners, $51 a year, which is what the city is estimating the average homeowner will pay. For some folks, that's a lot of money. For some folks, it's not so much money. In your mind, does the amount that an increase would cost a particular home matter at all when you look at what the money would go for and the reason that it's being levied in the first place?
Certainly, that's a lot of money, and that's for homeowners that are looking at property tax increases from other jurisdictions. Those tax increases tend to be in isolation, sold as being relatively small, but when you add up all the jurisdictions that are doing it, they can become very meaningful to homeowners and businesses alike.
Do you think residents generally understand how bonds like that work?
Certainly some do, but you know, the history surrounding this is that many don't. A lot of taxpayers don't understand that the bonds even have any property tax implication associated with it, despite the fact that the publicity pamphlets try to point that out and point out what the debt service is going to look to be over the next 30 years to pay them back. And that's why bond elections pass at a greater rate than, say, a override of a budget that is going to be paid with property taxes, because taxpayers tend to understand that the override is going to be something that impacts their property taxes versus bonds is a little less the case. You do have a lot of confusion associated with what approval of those bonds means to taxpayers and whether it's going to increase their taxes over time.
Kevin McCarthy is president of the Arizona Tax Research Association. Kevin, thank you.
You're welcome.
The average farm size in Arizona is decreasing. That's because more and more small farms are cropping up in the state. The same trend is true for Maricopa County, to the point where more than half the farms in the county were less than 10 acres in 2012. That's according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture census.
As the show's Annika Klein explains, the definition of a farm is changing, and with it, so are the people who call themselves farmers.
Picture a farm. Old McDonald's farm may be the image that comes to mind, with a cornfield here and a red barn there. But today's farms come in all shapes and sizes.
The whole plot itself is only a half acre, so the section that I have is an 80 north-south by about a 50 east-west.
Steve Entman is standing at the Phoenix Urban Research Farm in Central Phoenix. It's an incubator for beginning farmers like Entman, run by the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension.
I've got tomatoes that are starting to produce and getting the rest of my carrots out.
Entman is actually a police officer, but for years he's been farming in his free time.
It's a different type of farming.
Julie Murphy is with the Arizona Farm Bureau, an organization made up of stakeholders in the state's farming industry.
I see a trend with more very small, urban, even backyard size farms.
Murphy says when it comes to dollars, this subset of farms is just a drop in the bucket. Their revenues don't compare with larger farms.
But it has some of the greatest potential for growth.
At a farmer's market, a bus drops off about 15 people participating in a workshop for new farmers, also through the University of Arizona. Here, they'll learn about the one green they can't grow, money.
So they're in season. right now.
A market is one of the options they'll have for selling the fruits and veggies of their labor. Eric Gielen and his wife Carla are in the workshop.
We're from Illinois. We moved here in December.
The Gielens both retired from their corporate jobs, and now they're ready to call themselves farmers. Before this workshop, Eric says they had a different idea of what that meant.
In my mind, we go and walk into a Fry's or a Safeway and say, here's our stuff, why don't you sell it? And they've really helped us think that through a little bit.
The old farmers still have the wholesale market locked in. These new farmers are not going to be taking over grocery stores or restaurant chains. So what do they have to offer? Steve Entman, the farmer you heard earlier, says the answer is variety, something that's been largely weeded out of wholesale.
What I can do is I can find that dual-colored summer squash that you're not going to find in the store because it doesn't ship well or it's just not, doesn't have the same marketability.
And when Entman retires from his law enforcement job next month, he says he'll be a full-time farmer, tilling soil on that tiny plot tucked between skyscrapers as the train goes by. The picture of farming in 2016. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
Sedona is trying to find a way to turn the volume down. Some residents are complaining about the noise from sightseeing helicopters, and the problem is not a new one. Justin Clifton is Sedona City Manager, and he joins me. So, Justin, how big of a problem is helicopter noise in Sedona?
I think it probably depends on where you live. But imagine for a second that you bought a house up against the Red Rocks in an area where it's real popular. And now on busy weekends, especially during peak tourist season, you've got helicopters flying directly over your house, maybe 3, 4, 5 plus an hour. For those folks, it's a pretty big deal.
How big of a part of the city's economy are these helicopter tours?
I can't speak to the helicopter tours specifically, but obviously we're a tourist community and we want to be welcoming of tourists. So certainly I think there's a strong position out there that we shouldn't be prohibitive of these kinds of activities, even if they have a negative consequence. But I think what we would like to see is a little more effort to be good neighbors so that the tourist activity that generates, you know, valuable income for our local economy and the local residents who really want some peace and quiet can get along.
How do you try to make that balance?
I think it's difficult. One of the things that was discovered through our research, and really it was led by a citizen work group, was that there is an FAA advisory circular having to do with altitude. Basically says fly 2,000 feet above the highest terrain. If the helicopter tour operators followed that advisory, we think there might be better balance between the customers that they need to serve and the local residents.
Who would be in charge of enforcing that, though?
At this point, it's really not enforceable because it's an advisory. So one way to get there would be voluntary compliance. If all of those efforts fail, I think we would want to work with the local airport, perhaps the county who actually owns the airport. And if those things aren't successful, we might reach out to the FAA and see if there's a way to make this a mandatory requirement.
Have there been conversations with the helicopter tour operators about ways that they can still maintain their business and do what they're doing, but maybe do it in a way that gives some of the residents some more quiet?
I think that's really the direction that I have from our council, is to try to seek a cooperative arrangement with the airport, the county as the owner, and the tour operators. I haven't personally had many conversations. I know I've had at least one conversation with an operator that is in pursuit of buying quieter helicopters. So that's one positive example of trying to find better balance in this situation. I know other people have reached out to the tour operators with some limited success. So I think the question now is, can we re-engage in that dialogue and make more progress?
Would it be your preference to have voluntary compliance with things as opposed to having to have the city or the county or somebody else come in and say, tour operators, you must do this?
I would always prefer that it's voluntary. I mean, frankly, if we all sit down at the table and recognize the problem for what it is, which is both one of commerce and making sure our businesses thrive and one of maintaining a community where people enjoy a certain lifestyle, if we could get to some place where all involved were maybe not happy, but with a situation they could live with, that would always be better than trying to force someone's hand.
Is there a sense that this is something that you want to try to get done now before more tour operators come in and maybe the problem gets worse?
I'd like to say we want to get out in front of it, but frankly, this has been going on for a long time. In recent years, we've had a pretty healthy uptick in tourist activity, so I think the problem's gotten worse. And also recently, the airport has put out its own information through a long-range master plan that suggests it's at least possible that this activity increases substantially over the next decade or more. So while we're probably too late to be out in front, it's never too late to try to get after a significant issue before it gets any worse.
Justin Clifton is Sedona City Manager. Justin, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Longtime Phoenicians are familiar with Mel's Diner. It's the old-fashioned eatery along Grand Avenue, once featured in a 1970s movie and TV show. But what you may not know is that the place still exists and has kept its special place in Valley history, even with an owner from the other side of the world.
KJZZ's Phil Latzman decided to pay a visit to the world-famous truck stop that's become synonymous with Phoenix.
Early to rise, early to bed.
For non-natives like me, growing up back east, the only thing I knew about Phoenix and Arizona was what I saw on television.
It doesn't exactly say white Christmas.
Nobody has a white Christmas in Phoenix.
This is what I'm trying to tell you. I'm going to have one. Tommy and I, we're going to have a white Christmas.
What are you going to do, bleach a cactus?
Those are actresses Linda Lavin and Polly Holiday from the TV series Alice, which lasted 9 seasons on CBS from 1977 to 1985. The sitcom was based on a 1974 movie directed by Martin Scorsese called Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which featured a woman who got stuck in Arizona with her young son and found work in a diner. In the less serious TV series, Lavin played Alice and Holiday the acerbic waitress Flo, who delivered the show's most memorable line. Angie never knew who might show up at Mel's. For instance, legendary comedian George Burns in this episode with actor Vic Tayback, who played the Greasy Spoons owner and fry cook, Mel Sharples.
What are you doing in Arizona?
They're giving me an honorary degree at the university. Pretty good for a guy who only went as far as the fourth grade.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Look, kid, I was in the fourth grade so long, I wound up dating my teacher.
When I moved to Arizona, I needed to find out more for myself about this distant childhood memory. As it turned out, Mel's Diner, featured in the show's exterior shots during opening and closing credits, remains in operation and is still well known for its movie and TV history.
A lot of people will come in here and say, hey, can you tell me to kiss my grits? Or, you know, are you Flo? Are you Alice?
That's Christina Stivictakis, who says people come from all over just to sit at Mel's counter.
I've had people from Germany come in here and know the show very well. They dubbed it in their language. So that's kind of neat when we get foreigners that come over here and just know the show, know the restaurant, and they actually come, not they're just stopping by, but they were looking for this place.
Her brother-in-law, Manos Stivictakis, a Greek immigrant, bought the diner 11 years ago, not knowing a thing about its past.
No idea. Just the customers. I pick up the phone one day, and a lady was in the line, and she said, can I speak to Mel? And I was like, you have the wrong number. He said, no, Mel's got to be there.
After learning the history from his customers, Stivictakis quickly renamed his new establishment.
Never was named at Mel's Diner. But because everybody calling and he asked for Mel's, I said, you know what? There you go, Mel's Diner.
I've been telling people to kiss my grits for years. So
that's longtime customer George Sheffert, who says in many ways, from the famous sign out front along Grand Avenue to the terracotta floors and the bar stools inside, the place looks much like it did when it opened in the 1950s.
It's an old roadside diner, which is non-existent pretty much. You know, there's a few around the country, but this is ours, and it's nostalgic and quaint.
Fellow longtime patron Tom Hinsdale says Mel's represents a rare piece of Valley history that is still standing.
Most of Phoenix, the old Phoenix, has been torn down or bypassed or cemented over, and it's just a shame that so much of it has gone away, and this is one of the few spots left in town that you can drive up and say, gee, that's been there for a long time.
And Hinsdale says he's glad the diner's owner has preserved its history.
And the good thing about it is the people that own it now come from Greece, and they've picked up on the historical part of it, and they've tried to resurrect that part of it.
And that Greek immigrant Manos Stivakakis says he doesn't mind being called Mel.
I'm proud for that, to own a piece of history, you know? Like, it fits with us, with my family. We're loud. Mel's was loud. He was screaming. Like, when I working back there, everybody can hear me.
So the next time you're on Grand Avenue in Phoenix, give Mel's Diner a shout for a piece of Valley history. For the show, I'm Phil Latzman in Phoenix.
Yeah, there's a new girl in town, and she's looking good. There's a fresh...
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.